This is Tom Roy with radio news from Wavefarm's WGXC in New York. News about radio waves, transmission art, wireless surveillance, and other broadcast issues from wavefarm.org. Kevin Polson at Wired magazine reports that anonymous hacker Jeremy Hammond was sentenced to 10 years in prison on November 15th. The 20-year-old Chicago hacker pleaded guilty earlier this year to hacking the servers of Strategic Forecasting Incorporated, where he wiped out files and databases and stole 5 million private email messages and 60,000 customer credit cards. The emails he turned over to WikiLeaks, where they revealed some of the company's wrongdoings, while the credit cards were used by Anonymous for $700,000 in fraudulent donations to nonprofit groups. Hammond revealed that Stratfor was tracking the public movements of activists who were fighting Dow Chemical over the 1984 Union Carbide gas leak in Bhopal, India. Hammond could have been sentenced to 12 and a half to 15 and a half years. With good behavior and credit for time he's already served, he could be released by September 2021.
I think when Jeremy took this plea with a 10-year maximum, that he understood that this was a very likely outcome for him.
We have been in front of this judge on a number of appearances, and we have not found her to be particularly sympathetic to Jeremy. We don't think that she has the beginning of an understanding of the hacker movement, and she certainly doesn't have an understanding of the vocabulary used in chat rooms and by hacktivists online. I mean, it's a very overstated vocabulary, and they use the word kill. They don't mean kill. They use the word havoc. They use the word mayhem. But it's the way they talk, and she used that against him to deny any social value to the actual work he did, and therefore really just used his words against him.
The words that the judge used a lot and that the government used a lot in their sentencing submission were maximum mayhem. And the government and the judge felt that the idea of causing mayhem or causing destruction was incompatible with Jeremy's stated political goals. And we disagree with that. You know, advocating for political change, struggling for political change, involves being disruptive at times. It involves being destructive at times. These are sometimes the only pathways to change.
You can read Wired.com for more information about this story. Cyrus Farivar at ArsTechnica.com reports that on November 12th, the American Civil Liberties Union announced it had filed a formal request under the Freedom of Information Act, or FOIA, asking various federal judicial agencies what, quote, policies, procedures, and practices are followed to obtain search queries from search engine operators for law enforcement purposes, unquote. The ACLU also asked if a warrant or another legal process is required to make requests and if requests can be intercepted in real time. The ACLU is asking the Department of Justice, the FBI, the Drug Enforcement Administration, the Office of Legal Counsel, and the executive offices of the United States Attorney General and United States attorneys in California, Massachusetts, and Texas. The ACLU wrote on its blog, quote, "There are two kinds of information law enforcement might seek from a search engine: records of search queries entered by a particular person or persons, and a list of the names, IP addresses, or other identifying information for some or all of the people who have entered a particular query into the search engine's webpage." Representatives of the two largest search engines, Google and Bing, have suggested that they think the government needs a warrant to get this information. But we don't know what the government's policies are, nor how the search engines have reacted when presented with a government request for user search query data. You can go to ArsTechnica.com for more information about that. In the Philippines, amateur radio has been vital to recovery from Typhoon Haiyan, which hit the island nation last week. The American Radio Relay League is reporting how much amateur radio has helped out immediately after the disaster, with a second floor HF station in the Tacloban City Hall, the town most devastated by the typhoon, powered by a generator and maintaining communication with the outside world. You can go to the Amateur Radio Relay League.org, ARR.L.org, for more information about amateur radio helping out in the Philippines. Back in the United States, community radio stations across the country have been without national and international news since Free Speech Radio News shut down.
This is Free Speech Radio News.
In the 6 weeks since, Pacifica Radio has been distributing feature story news instead.
From feature story news in Washington and our bureaus around the world, this is FSN Reports.
But that trial basis is over, they've told stations. And as of November 18th, a feature story news is going to cost each station, no matter the size, $200 per month. Free Speech Radio News, in the meantime, says it's gearing up for a return in 2014 and has printed a list of carriage fees for stations to promise that they will pay to air the show in 2014. Pacifica Radio still owes almost $200,000 to Free Speech Radio News. And FSRN's new carriage rates are tiered with less money due from small stations and more from larger stations. Paul Rimsmondale has a report about this issue at radiosurvivor.com. There was lots of news at the Federal Communications Commission this week. The low-power FM deadline for filing applications was November 14th, and on that day, the FCC's website crashed. The FCC then extended the deadline one extra day to November 15th because its database system was, quote, briefly prevented or delayed some potential applicants from filing their Form 318 application. Tune in next week, and we'll start looking over the information of who applied and who might be getting a low power station in their community. John Egerton at Broadcasting and Cable Magazine says that FCC Chairman Tom Wheeler has told cell phone companies that they have to allow consumers to unlock their mobile devices and use them on other carriers after their existing contracts have expired. And he says that has to happen by December of 2013. Wheeler, the former president of the CTIA, the Wireless Association lobby that represents the cell phone companies, sent a letter to the current president, Steve Largent, telling him about the change. Quote, enough time has passed and it is now time for the industry to act voluntarily or for the FCC to regulate. Let's see a goal of including the full unlocking rights policy in the CTIA consumer code before the December holiday season, unquote. A CTI spokesman had no comment earlier in the week for broadcasting and cable. But a spokesperson for Public Knowledge, the consumer group, whose former president Gigi Sohn is now a top aide to Wheeler, said, quote, we're glad to see that the chairman and the FCC are continuing to fight for the interests of consumers and against foot dragging by the wireless carriers, unquote. Go to broadcastingcable.com for more information about this story. John Egerton at Broadcasting and Cable has another story about how the Library of Congress and WGBH in Boston with the Corporation of Public Broadcasting are creating a new archive of non-commercial TV and radio covering from the 1950s to 2010. They've got 40,000 hours that are being digitized and preserved in the archive with funding from the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Go to broadcastingcable.com for more information. In Variety, Ted Johnson reports that the FCC voted last week to allow foreign entities to invest more than 25% in broadcast stations, although the agency will still determine whether such investments can be made on a case-by-case basis. Formerly, no foreign company could own more than 25% of any broadcast, and new FCC Chairman Tom Wheeler claims rule change will help improve local broadcasting and minority media ownership. You can go to Variety.com for more information. In the heat of George Zimmerman's shooting of teenager Trayvon Martin, Spike Lee tweeted an address of an elderly Florida couple whose address he thought was George Zimmerman. Of course, when he tweeted the erroneous address, the couple, Elaine McLean and David McLean, were inundated with calls from people angry at George Zimmerman. Last week, McLean's attorneys filed a lawsuit against Lee for negligence. Lee countered with a motion to dismiss, revealing that he had already paid $10,000 to the couple to release claims against him. Eric Gardner in The Hollywood Reporter writes, the couple just have new lawyers who are now trying to hold Lee accountable for the retweets that others did of his original tweet. Go to The Hollywood Reporter website for more information about this story. At radiosurvivor.com, Matthew Lazar reports that the San Francisco Chronicle is calling for the resignation of KNBR's Damon Bruce after the San Francisco sports radio host went on an 8-minute rant about how women are ruining sports last week. Here's an excerpt of his rant.
I enjoy many of the women's contributions to the sports. Well, that's a lie. I can't even pretend that that's true. There are very few small handful of women who are any good at this at all. That's the truth. The amount of women talking in sports, to the amount of women who actually have something to say is one of the most disproportionate ratios I've ever seen in my frickin' life. But here's a message for all of them. This is for all the women, all the guidance counselors, all the sensitive men, everyone who ever got their mail or lived in Tiburon. Here's something for you. All of this world of sports, all right? Especially the sport of football, has a setting. It's set to men.
You can read Matthew Lazar's full report about this at radiosurvivor.com. English group Radio Arts are commissioning 4 new radio artworks of 30 or 60 minutes in duration. They have an international open call for new works at their website, radioarts.org.uk. There's a cash commission for each work. Artists should send a CV, a 500-word proposal, and relevant links to Dreamlands at radioarts.org.uk. Deadline is December 6, 2013 for 2014 showing. Again, go to radioarts.org.uk for more information. This week in radio history, on November 21st, 1959, the rock and roll DJ Alan Freed was fired by WABC-AM after he refused to sign an affidavit that he had not accepted bribes for playing certain songs in the Payola scandal.
Gang, thank you. Before we leave tonight, we'd like to say a special thanks. We don't have much time to thank everybody, and especially to our friends in the music business and to our wonderful friends here and all of you out there for your great loyalty. This is not goodbye. It's just good night, and we'll see you soon. Thank you.
On November 22nd, 1963, many United States radio stations suspended regular programming throughout the weekend. After the assassination of President John F. Kennedy, here's Walter Cronkite's famous relaying of the original news.
What you doing, Nancy? Cleaning up in here already?
Well, yes, that's right.
Ain't it a little early for that? Ain't Anna coming tomorrow?
Here is a bulletin from CBS News. In Dallas, Texas, 3 shots were fired at President Kennedy's motorcade in downtown Dallas. The first reports say that President Kennedy has been seriously wounded by this shooting. More details just arrived. President Kennedy shot today just as his motorcade left downtown Dallas. Mrs. Kennedy jumped up and grabbed Mr. Kennedy. She called, "Oh no," the motorcade sped on. United Press says that the wounds for President Kennedy perhaps could be fatal. Repeating, President Kennedy has been shot by a would-be assassin in Dallas, Texas. Stay tuned to CBS News for further details.
It takes more than an instant to make a real cup of coffee. That's why Nescafe has come up with a...
Further details on an assassination attempt against President Kennedy in Dallas, Texas. President Kennedy was shot as he drove from Dallas Airport to downtown Dallas. Governor Connally of Texas in the car with him was also shot. It is reported that 3 bullets rang out. The president, cradled in the arms of his wife, Mrs. Kennedy, was carried to an ambulance and the car rushed to Parkland Hospital outside Dallas. The president was taken to an emergency room in the hospital. We will keep you advised as more details come in. Stay tuned to CBS News for further details. This is Walter Cronkite in our newsroom in... There has been an attempt, as perhaps you know now, on the life of President Kennedy. He was wounded in an automobile driving from Dallas Airport into downtown Dallas, along with Governor Connally of Texas. They've been taken to Parkland Hospital there, where their condition is as yet unknown. We have not been told their condition. At Dallas, in the downtown hotel room, a group had been gathered to hear President Kennedy when he was waiting his arrival. Let's switch down there now, where Eddie Barker of KRLD is on the air.
As you can imagine, there are many stories that are coming in now as to the actual condition of the president. One is that he is dead. This cannot be confirmed. Another is that Governor Connally is in the operating room. This we have not confirmed. The president was whisked from the scene of the attempted assassination or assassination, depending upon his condition, of course, at this hour, by bus to Parkland Hospital. And the president undoubtedly is in the emergency room at that hospital, which would be on the first floor of Parkland. No word is yet. We are awaiting something more official. It is, of course, difficult, certainly, to go on scanty reports.
This is Walter Cronkite back at the CBS newsroom in New York. We have just been advised from Dallas that blood transfusions are being given to President Kennedy. Let us recall for you now what has transpired in this.
KRLD is reporting they've been told by somebody in the hospital the president is dead. Only a rumor, but they've been told that. KRLD is saying.
Well, that's a repeat of something that you heard reported to you directly a moment ago from KRLD television in Dallas, and that is the rumor that has reached them at the hotel that the president is dead. Totally unconfirmed, apparently, as yet. However, let's go back to KRLD in Dallas.
Operating room, we do not know what his condition is, but the report is that the president is dead. This is not confirmed. This is something that word just came to us a minute ago. The word we have is that President Kennedy is dead. This we do not know for a fact. The word we have is that he is dead, that he was shot by an assassin at the intersection of Elm and Houston Streets just as he was going into the underpass. The word we have is from a doctor on the staff of Parkland Hospital, who says that it is true. He was in tears when he told me just a moment ago. This is still not officially confirmed, but as I say, the source would normally be a good one.
That was Eddie Barker at our affiliate KRLD in Dallas, Texas, speaking from the room where President Kennedy had been scheduled to make an address to three Dallas organizations. But an assassin's bullets cut him down on the way to that meeting from the airport. It was just an hour ago that the incident took place. We have just learned, however, that Father Huber, one of the two priests called into the room, has administered the last sacrament of the church to President Kennedy. Regarding the probable assassin, the sheriff's officers have taken a young man into custody at the scene, a man 25 years old. We just have a report from our correspondent Dan, rather, in Dallas, that he has confirmed that President Kennedy is dead. There is still no official confirmation of this, however. It's a report from our correspondent Dan, rather, in Dallas, Texas. We're now going into that Dallas luncheon the president had planned to address. Let's go back. Prayers, we understand, are underway.
That we may reveal that calm that shall be sweet into thee.
Vice President Lyndon Johnson has not been seen in the corridors of the Parkland Hospital. He was said to perhaps have been slightly wounded in the arm. Mrs. Lyndon Johnson says that the vice president, though, is fine. Throughout the streets of Dallas, the Dallas police had been augmented by some 400 policemen called in on their day off because there were some fears and concerns in Dallas that there might be demonstrations, at least, that could embarrass the president, because it was only on October the 24th that our ambassador to the United Nations, Adlai Stevenson, was assaulted in Dallas, leaving a dinner meeting there. From Dallas, Texas, the flash, apparently official, President Kennedy died at 1 p.m. Central Standard Time, 2 o'clock Eastern Standard Time, some 38 minutes ago. Vice President Lyndon Johnson has left the hospital in Dallas, but we do not know to where he has proceeded. Presumably, he will be taking the oath of office shortly and become the 36th President of the United States.
On November 25th, 1960, the Amos and Andy Show made its final broadcast on the CBS radio network. And on the same day in 1960, the CBS radio network ended the last four remaining radio soap operas it was broadcasting. On this day in 1925, the Grand Ole Opry debuted on WSM in Nashville, but it was first called Barn Dance. On November 29th, 1929, NBC used its chimes for the first time. On November 19, 1954, the first mass-market transistor pocket radio was introduced, the Regency TR-1.
She's my transistor sister. I want a radio under her arm. But no one can resist her, 'cause she's loaded with a musical charm. It's Presley, Karen, and U.S. Bonds, and it's
This year, Thanksgiving is on November 28th, and many radio stations across the country play Alice's Restaurant, the very long Arlo Guthrie song. WGXC's Ron Pohowski talked to Alice Brock, Alice from Alice's Restaurant, who tells us this radio story.
How did you get into the restaurant business, given that you were an activist and an artist, really?
Nothing I ever wanted to do, but it was an idea for me that my mother had.
Ah.
I was living in the church, and there were a bunch of kids living with us, Arlo included, and I was cooking for all of them, lots of spaghetti. We didn't have any money. And my mother said, you know, you're cooking for all these kids. Nobody's giving you any money. Why don't you open a little restaurant? There's a diner for sale in Stockbridge. So I said, okay, that sounds good. What did I know?
What did you know? Well, I must say that... I really enjoyed when I was up in Provincetown the first time you gave me a copy of your cookbook, which I still have and use till today. It's very straightforward, and I like the philosophy of your cooking, which is you can pretty much do anything with anything, no matter
right.
how little you have. If you don't have enough dishes, you can just get a hubcap for an extra one. I think you told me that one time.
I was pretty reckless in those days.
Yeah, and but the best is, which I actually told my friend Marie this past week, who was having trouble making spring rolls and they were falling apart. I said, well, you just have to make believe that that's what you wanted them to be. And I think that
right.
is a good philosophy.
Bravado and confidence.
The song's called Alice's Restaurant. It's about Alice and the restaurant. But Alice's Restaurant is not the name of the restaurant. That's just the name of the song. And that's why I called the song Alice's Restaurant. You can get anything you want at Alice's Restaurant. You can get anything you want at Alice's Restaurant. Walk right in, it's around the back, just a half a mile from the railroad track. And you can get anything you want at Alice's Restaurant. Now it all started two Thanksgivings ago, it was on 2 years ago on Thanksgiving, when my friend and I went up to visit Alice at the restaurant. But Alice doesn't live in the restaurant, she lives in the church nearby the restaurant, in the bell tower, with her husband Ray and Facha the dog. And living in the bell tower like that, they got a lot of room downstairs where the pews used to be. And having all that room, seeing as how they took out all the pews, they decided that they didn't have to take out their garbage for a long time. We got up there, we found all the garbage in there, and we decided it'd be a friendly gesture for us to take the garbage down to the city dump. So we took the half a ton of garbage, put it in the back of a red VW microbus, took shovels and rakes and implements of destruction, and headed on toward the city dump. Well, we got there, and there's a big sign and a chain across the dump saying closed on Thanksgiving. And we had never heard of a dump closed on Thanksgiving before, and with tears in our eyes, we drove off into the sunset looking for another place to put the garbage. We didn't find one till we came to a side road, and off the side of the side road was another 15-foot cliff, and at the bottom of the cliff was another pile of garbage. And we decided that one big pile's better than two little piles, and rather than bring that one up, we decided to throw ours down. And that's what we did. Drove back to the church, had a Thanksgiving dinner that couldn't be beat, went to sleep and didn't get up until the next morning, when we got a phone call from Officer Obi. He said, "Kid, we found your name on an envelope at the bottom of a half a ton of garbage, and just wanted to know if you had any information about it." And I said, "Yes, sir, Officer Obi, cannot tell a lie. I put that envelope under that garbage." After speaking over for about 45 minutes on the telephone, we finally arrived at the truth of the matter and said that we had to go down and pick up the garbage, and also had to go down and speak to him at the police officer station. So we got in the red VW microbus with the shovels and rakes and implements of destruction, headed on toward the police officer station. Now, friends, there was only one or two things that Obi could have done at the police station.
The preceding show was recorded at Wave Farms WGXC in the Hudson Valley in New York State.